Sunday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Got a lot to get to today. Going to do the Lakers offseason preview. Also got some interesting news to get to. I want to talk about Steve Kerr's comments today about using the small lineup in response to a question that I asked him. Also, there's been a lot of talk about the Kevin Durant to Golden State and how the cap spike facilitated that and kind of dueling articles. So we want to hit on that a little bit. A few other little rumors out there as well. Danny has a take on the new resting guidelines as well that he's going to want to share. We're sponsored today by MeUndies. We're proud to say that for every pair of special edition Celebrate Undies you buy during Pride, MeUndies will donate $1 to the Los Angeles LGBT Center. Check out MeUndies.com/capspace today. And Blinkist. Go to Blinkist.com/capspace to start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan with either text or audio summaries of key insights of 2,000 of the best-selling nonfiction books. Let's start here with what Steve Kerr said. I wanted to ask him about this today because you and I have commented extensively, going back to last year, in fact, on this idea that he just does not want to play the small lineup. We talked about Andre Iguodala maybe not being quite right. He only played 21 minutes in game four. But here's what Kerr had to say about it, and then we can react when I asked him if that small lineup, why it hadn't played that much, and why if we're going to see it more.
Nate Duncan, Dunked On Podcast. Coach, we've only seen 17 minutes for the lineup with Draymond at center and Andre Iguodala. How come we haven't seen as much as that? I know there's been some foul trouble with Draymond, and can we expect to see more of that going forward?
Every game's different, you know. If we don't have to go to that lineup, we don't need to. You know, if we're winning and we want to stay big in order to handle the rebounding with Thompson, maybe we'll stay with Zaza. If we're down and we feel like we need to speed the pace up, maybe we'll do that. But every game is unique to its own circumstances, and we just adapt accordingly.
Do you feel like there's a downside to going to that lineup earlier, even if, you know, the game is not getting out of hand?
Not necessarily. We were playing so poorly, it didn't matter who we had out there for the reasons I just listed. We weren't boxing out. We weren't defending the point of attack. Our screen and roll defense was bad, letting all the shooters get open, offensive boards. So in that case, it doesn't matter who's out there. But again, if the circumstances dictate it, we'll play that lineup longer. It's not a lineup I've played for more than 16, 18 minutes in any game, I would say, over the last few years. Maybe 2 years ago in the finals, we played Andre a little bit longer. But even that game, we went big, you know, with David and Festus Ezeli. So it's not easy playing small for, you know, 40 minutes, especially against a good rebounding team.
So I thought this was pretty interesting, Danny, because, and again, I'm going to preface this by saying I think that Steve Kerr is a top two coach in the NBA, and I have immense respect for what he's helped create in Golden State to the point where it's such a great system that it runs really well without him. I still thought that this was very frustrating because he's basically saying here that he's not going to go to that lineup until they're down, and that he feels like, no, you just can't play that many minutes a game with that lineup. He's only started it once since the 2015 finals, where it just killed Cleveland once they were down in the series, of course. He started it plenty in that series, and it was great. That lineup has only played 17 minutes, as I mentioned, and I think their net rating is like 60 or something like that. And the starters with Pachulia are -1 over that many more minutes, of course. And it really does seem like it's just very, very conservative. And it's rare that, like, we'll go on one of those rants and then it turns out that it's actually kind of like confirmed essentially by what the coach says when you ask him about it directly.
Yeah, I didn't exactly expect that sort of a response, though. That is, I talked about this a little bit with Tim Bontemps without having heard that audio, which is interesting because he had and I had not, of Kerr in terms of this being a feature, not a bug for him. And while I have my own strong opinion on it and have made that very clear before and stand by it 100%, he has this different approach. It has gotten them to where they do. And one of the big questions that I have with Kerr is there are two different parts of this. One is it seems pretty clear that those lineups are the best lineups, and that he knows that because he turns to it when they're down. You know, it's kind of like when we need a win, when we need to come back, that's what we go to. And then the second part is, so how would that approach work if he was similarly conservative and they didn't have a distinct talent advantage? That's not necessarily a relevant question for the next couple of years for the Warriors. This team has an immense amount of talent, and Kerr's system is a part of the reason that has happened. But there will be a point, and I think we've seen this at moments with the Spurs, where these stubborn coaches that don't want to change until they're down, get burned by it.
Well, and he got burned by it in game seven last year when he just went back to Festus Ezeli for 2 minutes. And he has, it seems like to me, and maybe they have some data that shows this. I'm not aware of what that would be. And the only time that they've ever played that lineup extensively, they lost because they got killed in the first quarter, which was that game six. The only time they've played that lineup extensively early in the game, they lost because they got killed in that game six in the finals last year, early in the game. You know, they were down 31-11 at one point, I think, in that game. So this idea that, oh, we are going to wear down, we're going to run out of gas if we play this lineup that much, there's no proof of that whatsoever. Other than just this general idea that, well, you know, small guys have to go against big guys. But the fact of the matter is, Cleveland, if you play that lineup, they're probably going to have to downsize as well and not play Tristan Thompson. They're going to go with Kevin Love at center most of the time anyway. So I really just don't get it. And the big problem to me is they cannot stop the Cleveland Cavaliers unless they go to a lineup with Green at center, because Zaza Pachulia is just too slow and JaVale McGee doesn't have the defensive intelligence in the pick and roll and makes too many mistakes. And David West, who should still get more time if you have to play more of a traditional big, at least David West has more quickness and intelligence and can actually like catch a pass and make a layup and has some chance of hanging with someone like LeBron James on a switch, maybe. You know, so at least like try playing him with all the other four all-stars then if you can't play Iguodala that many minutes. But you know, all those guys, it is just very conservative. It's feel, it's, and then it also of course bleeds into this idea of, you know, all right, going to our best lineup and playing our five best guys a bunch of minutes, that's like almost counterintuitive to the whole like strength and numbers thing. And then also like when they go to that lineup, part of the reason why they're so much more successful is they run a Steph Curry pick and roll. And when they actually did run Steph Curry pick and roll in game 3, they were extremely successful. Even if it wasn't Steph making the play, they're getting a double team every time. And when you have Pachulia in the game, it's so much easier for them to do that strategy. So it really hurts Steph's production a ton as well. Even if Pachulia is like, you know, kind of an okay screener off the ball, that off the ball shit's not working.
Even if you ignore the changes in system, which I agree with you that switching out Pachulia for Iguodala opens things up in a very meaningful way, I think that this point is so basic but cannot be lost in this, which is when the Warriors go small, they add talent. Iguodala is a vastly superior player to Zaza Pachulia in most circumstances. I would say Livingston, you know, some of the other guys they've tried out there as well. When Cleveland goes smaller, they get worse. Tristan Thompson, for much of this year, was their third best player. He is their best or second best defender. And they're replacing him typically with Amon Shumpert or Richard Jefferson. Those guys are no slouches. They're talented players who can deserve minutes, but they're not as good as Tristan. They're not as good as Tristan Thompson. Tristan Thompson's really good. And so it's incredible to see that sort of a basic thing also be ignored. You know, there are certain teams where you're saying they're going, oh God, we don't want their small lineup on the floor. Cleveland's small lineup shouldn't instill that fear in the Warriors, and being small when Cleveland is big shouldn't either, especially because that gets Draymond Green off of Kevin Love and onto Tristan Thompson.
Yeah, it's really more important defensively to me than it is offensively, because you just have more ability to switch. You've got more mobility to recover, help, get out to shooters, which, you know, Cleveland just stretches the defense so much with their shooting, and you have more ability obviously to make Kevin Love pay defensively as well. Now none of this may matter, it probably won't. I mean, it's still, even if they play the exact same way they've been playing, their favorites in game 5, but it still is a little bit it was very surprising for me to see it be like manifest it, because I when I was going on that rant, you kind of were too, I was sort of like this idea that, like, you know, I never thought that Kerr would almost like kind of manifest that. No, and he's not going to agree with me that like that's a problem, but like this idea that you're just that, yeah, like, well, this is like the break glass in case of emergency, and we just like, we don't have to do this, so we're not going to. I was very surprised to hear that from him. All right, let's take a quick break here to talk to you about Blinkist. Blinkist is actually a product that I wish that I had invented. They certainly didn't steal it from me, but I had thought many a times as I would read nonfiction books that I wish this product existed, because most people, when you read nonfiction, you're not necessarily reading for entertainment. You're reading just so that you can find stuff out that will help you gain information that can be useful for you in your daily life. But how much of that are you really going to retain if you read a whole 400-page book where like, all right, I can actually use this in my life? The answer is, you know, maybe 15 minutes worth. Well, how about if you just spend 15 minutes getting that information into your brain instead of reading the entire book? That's what Blinkist can do for you. They have over 2,000 of the best-selling nonfiction books transformed into powerful packs you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes. Since you listen to this podcast, you probably like the idea of learning on the go with your smartphone. Imagine if you could listen to the key insights of a nonfiction book in just 15 minutes. That's what Blinkist does for you. Titles like How Champions Think, Shoe Dog, Mindful Athlete, How to Win at the Sport of Business. You could listen to 2 to 3 books, get those summaries of their key insights on your way home from work. It's pretty incredible if you are someone who enjoys learning as much as I do. It's a great way to do that in the absolute minimum amount of time. So the way to get started with them, you go to Blinkist, Blinkist.com/capspace. That URL, very easy to remember. We're going to talk about cap space with this Lakers offseason preview in a little bit. Blinkist.com/capspace. What else we got here?
Well, we can talk about the interesting kind of nuance, I guess you call it, with Fred Hoiberg. So Gary Parrish had reported that he was emerged as a candidate for Ohio State's job. Thad Matta is now no longer their coach. He has said that he is staying. I wonder how Bulls fans feel about that, but it's still interesting nonetheless because we still haven't seen a coach fired.
Yeah, Bulls blogger was like entertaining hope that he might not be there anymore. But alas, that hope did not come true. How about this Russ thing? You were critical of this on Twitter. Mark Stein did an interview with Adam Silver for ESPN Radio. Silver told Stein that these guidelines will quote unquote strongly recommend that home games only are used for rest, and they are to prevent resting multiple starters on the same night. What's your issue with that?
I have a couple issues with it. One is just the competitive balance thing, because you know each team, just by sheer happenstance, depending on how the schedule works out, they're going to get some advantages and some disadvantages, and I don't think that the computer that the league uses for scheduling is going to take that into account. It should. It's not. And then the other part is just the idea of starters. So some people are like, oh, this is easy. It is not easy. Think about a good example of this is Drew Holiday. So Drew Holiday missed the first little while of the season because of his to help deal with his wife's condition. And so is he their starter? Is the person who replaced him their starter? How does that work when a player is injured? You know, if Tony Parker tears his quad tendon in January instead of in April, is Patty Mills then the starter? Can they not sit him? Or if, since Patty Mills has only played 10 games as the starter, does it not count? And yeah, it might be more art than science, but I guess it's maybe the law background makes me go, yeah, I mean, this is at the present moment, it is only like a strong recommendation, but if they ever put punishment behind this, they're going to have to define these, and teams are going to try to game it. They're going to try to do other things, and it doesn't help. I get what they're going for, but if you're actively kind of trying to make your product worse in a way because you're just so afraid of losing revenue.
I'm not that worried about it, to be honest, just because really what this is designed to do is just prevent resting your best players on national TV games, and also to take away the concern of, all right, this is LeBron James one time in Memphis this year, and now we're not going to get to see him. And basically, if you think about it, it's kind of interesting. This is probably my biggest problem with it, is this idea that, well, Cleveland Cavaliers, you have a duty to the Memphis Grizzlies because you're the team that has the star, that you have to play this guy there. I get it that, you know, home fans may go to multiple games, but there's certainly plenty of fans that only go to one game at home. And, you know, it's going to hurt that team's revenue on the secondary ticket market or whatever through like the team website if they're trying to resell tickets or whatever, if they find out LeBron James isn't playing that day or whatever. But it's interesting to me, and perhaps, you know, this is kind of a collective. There's some socialist aspects to this, to be sure, that these 30 teams are all together, and they all, you know, when one team is good, another team is bad, they kind of support each other a little bit. But it is interesting to me that road games were prioritized over home games. I don't know if I agree with that, but ultimately the whole like multiple starters thing, I don't think that's going to matter, because number one, nobody's really going to care unless it's a national TV game, and number two, nobody's going to care unless it's like one of the top 15 players in the league. And so very few teams have multiple top 15 players in the league. And if they are, they're all clearly starters. So I don't know how much ambiguity there is there.
And if they want to make sure that they're not going to have rest games on national TV games, maybe don't have those games be on back-to-backs. That would help. And they haven't changed. It doesn't sound like they're working on changing those structural aspects other than adding a week to the season. Huzzah. But, you know, there are ways that you can change that. We know what the predictors are of when they're going to sit guys, and you can change those if that's what you're really caring about. But whatever. We'll see what they do. I'm openly skeptical, but optimistic that they'll figure something out. But we'll see.
Interestingly, Gordon Hayward reported by Mark Stein that, quote unquote, volume is rising on the whispers that Gordon Hayward to Miami is a possibility.
Couple things that are interesting here. One is the idea that it's the team that is worrying Utah, because that's sort of a different thing than the team that Gordon Hayward is more interested in necessarily. It depends.
Like, yeah, I'm sure... you know, I specifically omitted that just because I think that sounds more just like artful turn of phrase to make it.
See, I wasn't sure. Yeah.
I didn't put any stock in that. That's just my personal opinion there.
But... okay. I'm a parser. You know that. So that's the way that I am.
So I parsed it enough that I decided to just parse it out completely and not even say it at all. So,
but let's get into the nitty gritty of it. I mean, I've said before that I don't write Miami off for anybody anymore. There isn't a reason. They have a good team. They have a great front office. They're going to be, you know, competitive. They owe two first round picks to Phoenix. So you have that as like one way that they're not going to get as better, but it's a lifestyle thing. And when a player is getting their first time at unrestricted free agency, we don't know what they're going to value. I still think Boston is a better fit for him in terms of talent, competing for championships. If he's going to leave Utah has its own. I mean, they're going to be a great team if they bring him back. But I understand why Miami would scare teams, because they can sell a lot of different pitches that other teams can't.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't buy these rumors, because I don't think like Gordon Hayward is one of those white dudes that tans very well. He looks like he just would like burn in that Miami sun. I think maybe he's just safer in Utah. But there's
fun to be had indoors in Miami, from what I understand.
Yeah, I mean, he's married. I don't think he's like that into that kind of stuff. We'll see. I don't know him personally, but to me, this doesn't make any sense, because Utah, if he stays there, is going to be better than Miami, I think, even though they have to contend with maybe more talent in the West. And Utah can offer him a little bit more money. And you know, if you go to Miami, you're just kind of another guy who's played in Miami. Whereas Utah, I mean, he would be a Utah legend if he plays another three or four seasons there and plays at a high level. I mean, they haven't really had much in the way of like long-term stars there since Stockton Malone. I mean, he would be the guy identified with the Jazz from like the last like 20 years, probably, if he sticks around any longer. But anyway, we'll see. I mean, I don't understand why he would go to Miami other than just the lifestyle stuff, because Boston and Utah, in my opinion, both give him a better chance of competing. All right, let's move on to the LA Lakers here. It's a rarity, but I actually don't expect them to do that much in free agency, in part because Magic Johnson said that himself.
Yeah, that certainly helps indicate it. And Johnson is, of course, very comfortable with the media, but also because there are direct incentives for them to not do so. Because for the Lakers specifically, but also broadly, the 2018 class fits them better than 2017. And as is the case for many teams that spent recklessly last summer, they're not really going to add much space between this summer and next summer, because the only guys coming off their books are Corey Brewer and Tarik Black, assuming they pick up his non-guaranteed contract, which guarantees pretty early in the offseason. And because you have that money that comes off, that's about $14 million. But then they also have Julius Randle jumping from making about $4 million to a cap hit of $14.5 million, thanks to the new CBA upping, thanks to Kawhi Leonard and Andre Drummond and all those guys, upping the cap holds for these draft picks.
Yeah, they took on Corey Brewer's salary this year in that Lou Williams trade. So if you're planning on using cap space, you probably wouldn't have made that trade this offseason. There's nobody really that sexy to go after. It's Gordon Hayward. Chris Paul is not, you know, probably not going to want to go there. And they're bad. They realize that. They know how bad they are and that they can't necessarily attract a free agent. I mean, they are lucky, it seems like, that Paul George has this affinity for them. And so right now, if they were to keep Black, who has a non-guarantee of $6.6 million this year, they've only got $15.7 million in space. And the only downside for them is there's really no way to use that money to just take on bad contracts. contracts because there aren't really any bad contracts that end this year. And they don't want to take on any money past this year. So, I can't, because, you know, in 2015, 2014, like none of those contracts really are that bad, right? Like, because they were signed under the old cap, and there aren't really any two-year deals that were signed in the summer of 2016 that are that bad. Either. So I don't know how they're going to get much out of that space. I mean, maybe they just try to sign one guy for a 1 year contract, and we'll talk about who that might be to spend $15 million. I mean, I think they definitely should keep Tarik Black. I think for that $6.7 million, I think he's a reasonable backup center. Guaranteed date of July 3rd. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, especially because you don't want a multi-year contract. So I don't think they're going to get kind of a backup center that's better than him. They might as well have him on roster. And again, it's a 1 year contract. So I think that's a totally worthy use of that $6 million or so.
Yeah. The more interesting thing is that summer of 2018, when Paul George will presumably be a free agent. We'll talk about the idea of maybe acquiring him in trade before that as well. George's maximum salary would start at $30.6 million that year. If they strip everything off the books for that season, they'd have $34.8 million, so they could fit in Paul George. Now, they would be very hard pressed to get another superstar, and of course the reason for that is that Luol Deng and Timofey Mozgov will be making $34 million combined that year themselves. I would not expect to see them under any circumstances try and trade Mozgov and Deng this year, but because it's just 3 years and about $54 million left on the contract for Deng, and 3 years and $48 million left on the contract for Mozgov. But presumably they're going to be in a situation in the summer of 2018. And you mentioned Randall's cap hold too, right? So basically, unless they clear space, they either got to give up Julius Randall, or they've got to dump Deng or Mozgov, essentially, or Jordan Clarkson as well, who's making about $12 million a year over the next 4 years. And Clarkson might actually be someone that a team could be interested in, although he's older than you think. He's like 25 already. Let's say that they want to move on from Deng and Mozgov with 2 years each left on those contracts at $18 and $16 million a year. I mean, holy crap, what would it take to get rid of that?
Well, you've used the line before about $20 million for a first round pick, and I think that's reasonably fair. And those guys are providing some surplus value. I think Deng provides a lot more than Mozgov. You know, you're not just taking on dead money, but
yeah, you know, you could see Deng being like a $6 million a year player, an $8 million a year player by that point.
Sure.
Mozgov is probably just, you know, a backup center who's worth like $3 or $4 million a year.
And they already owe their 2018 first round pick unprotected to the Sixers because they were able to hold through that protection for over all those years since the So they have that. They don't have any first round picks out beyond that, so it's a good thing in general. And then they have some basically second round picks out and in, so you can call that a wash. It's not exactly a wash, but it's close enough. And
dude, if they ever ask you to write like a 100 things that every Laker fan should know before they die, like them keeping those two protected picks this long would have to be a chapter, clearly.
Oh, absolutely. And we could do one. I could do one on the Sacramento book on their protection too. Hey, I have a chapter on the Gilbert Arenas provision. I can get into CBA minutiae and publish books.
So anyway, and if they could move on from both those guys, now you could fit in basically two max contracts, especially, and maybe it would just get to the point where they would just, I mean, it would be completely crazy. They might, although if they tried to stretch those guys, they might even come close to running into the provision that you can't have more than 15% of your total salary stretched, or paid out to stretch players. So that could be an issue too. They might not, I'd have to go and check and see whether they could actually stretch both those guys at the same time, but it's still, it would cost a pretty penny, but maybe, you know, if there's another max guy who wanted to go there in the summer of 2018, and I mean, the superstars in the summer of 2018 right now, DeMarcus Cousins, possibly Kevin Durant, if he does another 1+1, you have to imagine that he wouldn't be included. LeBron James, and of course, there were a few rumors about the idea that he would want to go play for one of the LA teams. I'll blue that when I see it, but you know, maybe it's a possibility. I'm not really sure who else, though, you're going to want to use max money on other than Paul George. And I think this idea that you're going to get two max stars to go with like Lonzo Ball. And actually, I'm sorry, excuse me, I forgot to include Ball's salary in there. So you're really, to get George next year, you're going to be kind of up against it. You almost would have to move on from Deng, Mozgov, or Clarkson, or just hope the cap goes up a little bit more. So it's definitely, I mean, it's just incredible. Like the Mozgov and Deng contracts have got to be like next to moral hazard in the dictionary. And all these, if you're a Laker fan who gets pissed at us for making fun of how terrible those contracts are, well, here's your problem. Like you can't even fit in Paul George next year unless you make some moves. You're gonna have to give up all kinds of treasure to open up more space. You could have maybe had two max slots in the summer of 18 if you had managed things well, and instead, because Jim Buss and Mitch Kupchak both were desperate to keep their jobs and didn't know what would be a good way to keep their jobs and how to spend that money appropriately, then you just have these albatross contracts.
So you mentioned earlier the idea of taking on single year salary, and something we haven't discussed in any of these off-season previews, but I think the Lakers are a good place to do it, is whether teams would give up anything of value, and we can define a value later, for these small partial guarantees of guys that they don't want to keep. So a good example of this would be like Aaron Aflalo. Let's say the Kings don't want Aaron Aflalo on their books. Anthony Tolliver could have been the same way. Would they give up some sort of
menial asset? Oh, by the way, did we report already that Tolliver got stretched on this show?
Yeah, I did it ever get a third retweet?
the only thing I've ever reported that the Kings did not stretch Tolliver. I don't think it ever did.
But
surprisingly
enough,
people were not retweeting that during game four of the NBA Finals. Wasn't huge on the radar at that point.
But so for example, like actually the best one is probably Festus Ezeli. So yeah, it does matter to the Blazers if they can get out of Festus Ezeli's, I think it's $1 million is his partial guarantee.
Right.
But are they willing to give up, you know, like a late second round pick or the rights to some Euro stash or something like that for that? Because if they are, the Lakers should be going after those guys. Otherwise, you're looking more at those.
It's just going to be cash probably. They'll just pay cash and then waive them. And like it's because they're over the tax. And the Kings maybe once you get to $2 million, you might like, but I mean, I think they'd rather just have the second round pick given where they are and the fact that they owe that 2019 second rounder and the fact that they're not going to be good for a while. So their second rounders are pretty good.
So then you're looking at these kind of, it's funny that they're like white injured big men, but Spencer Hawes and Josh McRoberts are probably the two best ones. But again, it ties in with the idea of though, of would those teams give up assets? Because the Miami
doesn't have anything, right?
Right. Miami doesn't have anything in Milwaukee. Maybe. I mean, maybe they're going to do that, but you're probably going to get like a middling second round pick. Now, I would consider doing that if I were them. And you get Spencer Hawes back in the Staples Center where he's made such great memories when he was a Clipper. So maybe that's an advantage too. But I think that might be worth it. That's the sort of thing that they should approach. But it's a good illustration of how hard it's going to be to find those trades that I went through every single team. And that's what I came up with.
What about the idea of trading for Paul George now? What are the advantages? Before we talk about, I mean, obviously you have to give up something, but just in a vacuum, to me, I would almost rather just go after him in free agency a year from now than trade for him now because, you know what the reasons are.
So does Dwight Howard.
Yeah, because he could come there and maybe he doesn't like it and then he leaves them in free agency after they made this trade for him. And then also, if you do trade for him, you get his bird rights. Now you have to give him a five-year deal. And I'm not sure that I want to be paying Paul George the max. I don't think that he will be necessarily worth that at the end of that contract for the fifth year. I'd rather have him on a four-year deal, frankly, which is the most, of course, that you can sign him to in free agency.
I don't think
at least you know for sure that he's there for 4 years, he's yours. Whereas if you trade for him, you can't extend him at a market rate. So I guess maybe they could renegotiate and extend him somehow, but then they would have to send bad salary back to Indiana, which they're not going to want.
Right.
And they're
out
that draft.
Indiana's considering Paul George this massive asset because he's the best player they've had since Reggie Miller. So you're not going to exactly get him as a favor. You know, even if they think that's where he's going to end up, another team will probably give them meaningful assets as a rental if that's what they decided they wanted to do. I don't think the raises are as big a part of it. That's the other component of getting Paul George now, is that you could give him 8% raises as opposed to 5%. I don't think that Lakers necessarily need that advantage. maybe another team feels like they do against the Lakers to make their offer there. The years matter a lot more than the slightly increased dollars. And also, it's just the idea of, do you want him to be a part of this team as they're still kind of working through it? This would definitely be, if you're an optimistic Lakers fan, this would be the worst year of his time. So do you really want that to be the reflection? The hope is that, you know, Lonzo or Fultz or whoever they end up with is going to be, you know, they're going to set the world on fire. But we know that rookie point guards, especially young rookie point guards, don't always work out that well. So what is the benefit of getting him now, other than reducing the risk that somebody else trades for him? And is Paul George at 28 years old so good that you can't let that go, that you just have to make sure that you lock him up and you can't just wait for the next good free agent, whoever that may be?
Yeah. Now, the one appeal of getting him this year is that maybe they could get a lot better, you know, and like start to get close to playoff contention, at least look like they're on the way up. I don't know if this team with Paul George actually makes the playoffs. Their young guys would all have to take quite the leap, but then maybe if they were able to move Mozgov and Dang, they could find a way to get another free agent in there because they look a lot better and Paul's already there and he can recruit for you as well, you know, like that. But I agree. I mean, then you also, there's the matter of the assets that you have to give up to get him. And it's hard for me to imagine, you know, maybe there's, if they could also dump Mozgov or Dang on the Pacers, but I don't know that they have enough ammo to do that unless they're going to include, I mean, is D'Angelo Russell enough to get that done if you're the Pacers to say, all right, not only are, you know, because we only have 1 year left of Paul George, and maybe that happens at the trade deadline as well. You know, we could see it happen there. It could be more realistic, but yeah, it's pretty risky, certainly, to trade something, but maybe at least if you can get off that money, it becomes more palatable. I don't know.
Yeah, I just don't think it's that strong of a case, especially considering, you know, what Indiana is going to be asking for. So I think we've kind of gone through that. Should we mention the other? I mean, I didn't think Nick Young was going to wait this long to make his option decision because a lot of other guys have, but theoretically, I mean, I guess that's more interesting.
Yeah, well, and we will get to that momentarily right after this from MeUndies. Pride starts in the inside, so you can celebrate yourself with MeUndies. They make the ultimate feel-good undies with free shipping right to your door, satisfaction guaranteed. These are the most comfortable pairs of underwear that I've ever owned. They are designed in LA, and they are made with micromodal, a fabric 3 times softer than cotton. These soft, stretchy undies come in an ever-changing array of colors and patterns. And because MeUndies believes in people feeling good and being themselves, they are putting their money where their underwear is during Pride Month. For every pair of special edition Celebrate Undies you buy during Pride, MeUndies will donate $1 to the Los Angeles LGBT Center. And as if you need another reason to buy them, they're offering $20 off your first pair and a satisfaction guarantee that you'll love them or your money back. The way to get started with them, MeUndies.com/capspace is that URL. Easy to remember the /capspace URL, of course. MeUndies.com/capspace. If you pick up a special edition Celebrate pair of underwear, you'll not only get a discount on awesome undies, you'll be donating to an awesome cause. So what else we got here? Nick Young, his player option, I have it as 1 day before the draft is his deadline to decide. He almost certainly will opt out, leaving him with a $10.3 million cap hold. He's due $5.7 million next year. We thought that would be absolute dead salary, but he had a pretty solid year shooting, I think, around 40% on three-pointers, lauded by Luke Walton for his defense, although any defense at all on this porous Lakers squad would have stood out. I'm not sure I'd buy that he's like some above-average defensive player, but I mean, I think he should certainly beat that $5.7 million in guaranteed money, and maybe we'll just see them bring him back on a larger 1 year deal now if they just can't use their cap space elsewhere.
Or maybe something sort of in line with the Jarebko Amir Johnson contracts, with the idea being that they could maybe move him if they need to clear that money in 2018.
Yeah, so they'll remember the new rules now for non-guaranteed contracts would make that a little bit more difficult, because
that's a good point.
One signed under the new CBA, now if you have non-guaranteed money for that year, you only count at the amount of the guaranteed money for trade purposes. But I mean, maybe they could just do that just so that they want to keep him around, they can. If not, they could always just cut him and try to do better in free agency. But Young, I think he certainly seems to like LA, so we'll see what happens with him. And you know, as a nominal 3-and-D player, a reformed 3-and-D player, perhaps, at least for the D part, he might be more in demand elsewhere for a team that's trying to win, could use a little bit of instant offense. Let's say that they just decide, all right, we'd like to get a little better this year. We've got $15 million to use, but we don't want to put any money into 2018 for obvious reasons. Who do you think would be someone that they could realistically get on a one-year $15 million deal, perhaps with that non-guarantee, like you mentioned, in the next year?
It's hard because a lot of guys want multiple years, you know, so you're not going to be getting Rudy Gay probably on a contract like that, let's say. So maybe you're looking at...
Well, do you want to start with what they need first? Maybe that's where we should start, is what this team needs.
So if we assume, and we could talk about this later, that they're going to draft a point guard probably is not their biggest need. They have a bunch of centers, even though their centers aren't particularly great. You know, Zubac, I think, is deserving of more minutes this year. I liked what they got from him. They have Mozgov, and they're not going to move him, so you might as well give him some as well. And then Tarik Black, we already discussed. So I would say the biggest need is whatever you think is best fitting next to Brandon Ingram. So if you want a four, if you want a three, either way. And I'd say that's probably the biggest thing. That's why I mentioned Rudy Gay first, is because I think of Brandon Ingram long term as a power forward, so I'd want a three next to him.
I mean, a stretch four or a stretch five, I think, is really important for this team, just to have that option of, yeah, maybe we're not going to stop people, but we're probably not going to stop people anyway. So why don't we at least give our young players some room on the floor, which they basically have never had with some of these centers that they've had. And Randall, of course, as well, if he's going to play a lot, he's going to play at the four, doesn't have likely three-point shooting range unless he really develops it over the off season. So in that vein, you know, maybe if like someone like a Mike Muscala slips through the cracks a little bit, you know, like a one-year $9 million deal for someone like him. I think Tolliver actually would be an interesting choice. Also a good vet in the locker room as well, though Tolliver may want to go somewhere where he can win a little bit more. You know, Ersan Ilyasova would be another guy, depending on how much the league is valuing these guys. Because we've mentioned these guys for a lot of teams, but we also believe in shooting maybe more than some people do.
How about Dante Cunningham? Maybe a little lower really more tier?
I think they just they're too impacted at the three and the four right now. I think they really, and especially in terms of like combo fours, I mean, they already have Dante Cunningham, but a better version of him, and his name is Luol Deng. So I don't see any reason to get him. And I mean, they definitely... The other nice thing too about having like a stretch center is maybe like that means you can play Deng more at the four. They're going to do their best to rehabilitate his value, so it doesn't cost quite so much to trade him, hopefully. But they do have these young centers they're trying to develop a little bit, Black, Zubac, and they still, of course, have Mozgov too, who maybe just be totally beyond rehabilitation. And I mean, just someone too who can just be like a pure spot up shooter. It'd be nice to have that guy too. You know, maybe another run for Jody Meeks. But I mean, they've got Clarkson, Russell, they're gonna have Lonzo Ball probably. By the way, I do not buy this whole idea that they're gonna like not draft Ball. That would be very surprising to me. And I mean, I guess maybe they are just trying to like boost the value of this pick for trade purposes, and they actually had like Dennis Smith in for a competitive workout today, and he's projected well below their range. This idea that they might like trade down or something, they're perhaps trying to work the market there, but I would be very surprised they didn't just draft Ball. And yeah, so they got Clarkson, Russell, Ball, and that's like your three guard rotation right there, because none of those guys can play anything above the two. And then you've got Ingram, Deng. Hey, maybe they probably actually could still use another wing, though. Yeah, I think you're right about that. So who might we see there?
Our old friend Omri Caspi would be interesting. I don't want him on the Lakers, but that would be a possibility. Yeah, see, it's hard. I wouldn't ever see Tyreke Evans go there on a one-year make good.
Brandon Rush returning to Luke Walton, who actually got a lot out of him with the Warriors. As soon as Steve Kerr came back, Rush stopped playing. So maybe Rush has some fond memories of Steve Steve Curry's the kind of one-year deal type of guy you might see there, can shoot it.
If the Kings decided not to extend the qualifying offer for Ben McLemore for some reason, I would be very intrigued with something like the Lakers, even though they have a bunch of guards, just with the idea of if they would give him a one-year deal as a make good, there might not be that many better
He'll
options.
He'll get a qualifying for offer. He'll
I think he will too.
For the Kings.
But
yeah, I guess you can also say, hey, maybe if they're trying to move Jordan Clarkson, who, you know,
right,
reports
then,
have
that's
indicated
kind of
are available.
What I was getting at.
Yeah, now maybe you need another guard there. I mean, what do you think of Clarkson's contract? Is that where is he on the NNA test?
At this moment, I think he passes it for most teams, even if you see him as a backup guard, just because those, I think we're going to see some of those contracts get a little bit ridiculous this year. But I could be wrong. You know, I think we'll see some good calibrators because Waiters should get more than that. And he's better than Jordan Clarkson to me. So maybe I'm inflating what those guys are going to get, but I think they're going to cash out a little bit. And also Clarkson's ability to create off the bounce is more valuable on the second unit when teams are looking for shot creation a lot more. I don't think he's a starter, but I don't think he's being paid like a starter.
He's an interesting player. With his size, there's no reason why he shouldn't be able to be decent defensively in like an actual real system. He's got the tools for it. He can shoot some, he can pass some, he can score some. He's pretty athletic. But you would have to say for what he is right now, he's overpaid. Maybe he can move beyond there. I mean, I think he's right on the borderline. If you're a team, we've talked about like a team that just doesn't have any young talent, like the Nets, that he could potentially be a good fit there. I mean, if I were the Nets, I would probably just take him on, you know, just at what his salary is. But if you're a good team, I don't know that I would be willing to take the risk that he just never develops further.
Right. I'll give you a good example of where I think he could make some sense is Orlando. So Orlando has less cap space than anybody really thinks. And so he could kind of, for some of these teams, nuzzle in to that area between the salary cap and the luxury tax. So if they just have a, you know, expiring contract or something that they just don't really want, and you get Jordan Clarkson instead, you'd be pretty thrilled with it.
Yeah. And you know, we've talked about this. How many teams have we said, wow, they have nobody to create? Like maybe they could look at like Tyreek Evans or something, right? Evans in his prime is better than Clarkson, but Clarkson probably a better shooter and obviously it doesn't have the health concerns that Evans has. So maybe I am undervaluing him because there just are not that many guys, especially someone who has pretty good size, who can actually create some shots. And he definitely, I would like to see what he could do just running a lot of pick and roll with some spacing around him. But perhaps he's a very difficult guy to evaluate, I think, overall.
I have a complete off-the-wall shot-in-the-dark idea.
Okay, these are always good.
Jordan Clarkson and Enes Kanter. So Kanter has a player option for next year, which he might pick up. But I feel like at that point, maybe somebody would even just want him for that money. So you're taking a little bit of a risk because he's more expensive. But you get, if you see him as just kind of getting out of that contract, and for OKC, I mean, Kanter helps, but he's not essential to what they're doing. And they need shot creation in the worst way. And the only other assets they have are the mid-level exception or the 21st pick. They're not getting a guy with those that works.
Yeah, I love your idea, but the Lakers don't have their 2018 first rounder, Danny. So I don't know why you'd want to get the one guy who might make their defense even worse than it already is.
Yeah, but he makes their offense
better. I don't see what the Lakers want with Enes Kanter. He's not going to be a cornerstone. He can't start for them. I don't think Kanter really makes sense for a lot of teams, but especially them. They're at that point, I mean, I think I'd much rather have and play Zubac for, you know, $16 million a year less and just try to develop him instead.
Yeah, I guess that logic applies more if you feel that Clarkson fails the NNA test than if he passes it.
Yeah, and I think he's a better value contract than Kanter, perhaps. And I also, it wouldn't shock me, I think Greg Monroe will be an excellent litmus test this summer for whether Kanter is going to opt in or not. So that'll be interesting. We're going a little too far afield. I guess they do still have Corey Brewer on this team, too. He might even be in the rotation. But again, because they can't tank this year, you know, we may see some different rotational
ideas. Oh, they can tank. It just won't help them.
Yeah, well.
I mean, we saw that with the Nets last year.
Yeah, that's right. They tanked on the last day of the season for whatever stupid reason. What else do we have to talk about in their
Tyler
offseason?
Tyler
Ennis. Are we about done? Oh, yeah. This was an interesting one.
Yeah, so Tyler Ennis is the new Austin Rivers, which means a player who was who had his fourth-year player option on the rookie scale declined.
Fourth-year team option.
Fourth-year team option, sorry. And had it declined and then was traded after that declined option. And so what that means is that the team, in this case the Lakers, that that ended the season with him cannot pay that player, even though he's an unrestricted free agent, cannot pay that player more than the value of the option that was declined. And so in his case, that's about $2.7 million. So I don't know if that's enough for Tyler Reddis. I legitimately don't, but it's always fun to see how these guys work out.
Yeah, you'll recall that Rivers, in that same situation, got in what was probably a more favorable player market as well, got a 1+1 for basically the most that they could pay him. And then he opted out again and got that three-year, $36 million 2+1. So he certainly did well. Unfortunately, the coach of the Lakers is not Doc Ennis, so perhaps that path will not work as well for Tyler Ennis. But he did show me something down the end of the year, and he was instrumental in what we thought at the time was a disastrous five-game winning streak to close the season. I actually was impressed with what he was able to do defensively, and started hitting some shots as well. And he's, you know, pretty young. He was drafted as after his freshman year 3 years ago, so I think that he certainly is someone that should be in demand as a potential backup point guard. It's a risk, obviously. He doesn't have much of a track record of performing well, but he's young enough to improve, and it'd be nice to maybe try and get him for pretty cheap now, and maybe he can grow into, you know, a Corey Joseph level type of player, maybe a little bit better shooter, but probably not as good defensively. But to be that sort of a player, I mean, if I were the Lakers, I guess the problem is they can't offer him a 1+1 because, again, they're worried about keeping open space for next year. I guess you could say, well, $2.7 million, you can always get rid of that if you have to. But I don't know if that's enough to keep him, frankly, unless they offer him even more years. And then why do you want to lock in at a low salary for even more years than that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the other downsides of the low rookie scale. And that's part of what they were trying to do in the CBA was punish teams for declining those options. And of course, also prevent a workaround from the CBA. So yeah, well, I get why the rules are.
I was going to say too, if you're him and they're drafting Lonzo Ball and they already have D'Angelo Russell, who's like kind of a point guard too, and they still have Jordan Clarkson, unless they trade Clarkson, I don't want to go back there. I mean, because the most they can offer me is 2.7. I might as well just go somewhere else where I have more of a chance to get backup point guard minutes, and I can potentially even get more money this year too. Or even if, you know, it's just, you know, a 2-year, $4 million deal or something, at least I've got a chance to get some more minutes now.
Yeah, totally agree.
So they also have, we mentioned the number 2 pick, they also have the number 28 overall pick from that trade with the Houston Rockets involving Lou Williams and taking on Corey Brewer's salary. They will have an upcoming rookie extension for Julius Randle. I would be very surprised if they extend him for the reasons, again, that we talked about. And but because they are planning on trying to use cap space, his cap hold is large enough, and I think he also is going to still, it was a number 7 pick, he probably considers himself, you know, a potential budding star. I don't know if I agree, but many players who are drafted that high feel that way about themselves, and he does have some talent. I think he could be a very interesting trade piece. I don't know how much they can get for him, but I would be watching very closely to see if they move on from him with the thinking that, hey, we're not going to re-sign this guy because we just don't have the money. So we might as well, especially at the trade deadline, if he's not like killing it for him, and they're just like, all right, can we get something for him? Even if it's like, you know, a second rounder or a late first, something like that.
When I talked to Darius Soriano, who runs Forum Blue and Gold, we talked about this and the idea with the changeover in the front office being important because they're not as wedded to these players that the prior administration drafted. And that includes D'Angelo Russell too, assuming they draft another point guard. But to me, the earlier, the better if they make a decision that those guys are not a part of the next great Lakers team, because then it gives somebody else who might believe in them, it gives them more time to figure it out. And I think they can get a better return. So I think that's true with both of those guys, but Randle being the most important because he's about to get properly paid.
Yeah, unfortunately, he hasn't shown enough to me that if you attach him to Deng or Mozgov, that you could move on from them. Hey, maybe it's him and you throw in a pick and now you could start to get close if there's a team that really likes Randle. But we'll see. I mean, he's got some potential too. It's just, it's so hard to fit in around him, which is something I actually went on. You mentioned Darius. I went on his podcast at Forum Blue and Gold last week, and we talked a lot about his fit in the modern NBA. But I mean, I think there is at least a 50% chance that as of, you know, July 15th, 2018, he is no longer on the Lakers.
Oh, we should also mention David Nwaba. This is something they did with his contract that I really like. They made his minimum contract a team option. So what that means is if they decline it, then he becomes a restricted free agent. I mean, I don't expect that you would decline that and then be like, hey, yeah, we got him as a restricted free agent. But at least it gave them some flexibility.
Yeah, the only real upside to doing that is if you wanted to get him and lock him into a longer deal. Because at the time, I don't think they had cap space. That was the longest deal that they could give him was 2 years under the minimum exception. And Nwaba was instrumental in their tanking efforts. He's pretty athletic. Can't shoot at all, but it's... I would imagine they would keep him around. I don't see any reason not to. And he still would be a restricted free agent next year anyway. This is his rookie year. So, but it was an interesting structure. And I think there isn't an indication on whether that team option is also non-guaranteed. In fact, it would have to be guaranteed because they didn't have a non-guarantee this year. So basically, if he's on the team... And so maybe what they even do, Danny, is they decline that option and then they re-sign him in restricted free agency to a minimum contract that has more non-guarantees on it. Maybe that's what they end up doing.
Could be.
That's probably, yeah. Thank you for that short response because we've spent enough time on David Nwaba now. Anything else you wanted to talk about with these guys before we wrap it up here?
Not really. I mean, let's just clarify that for both of us, if Markel Fultz is off the board, if we were the Lakers, as of knowing what we know right now, we'd take Lonzo Ball.
Yes, I agree with that.
And then straight best talent available at 28, because when you're that low, you're just trying to take a shot at a dartboard.
All right, that'll do it for today. Don't forget about our sponsors today, MeUndies, MeUndies.com/capspace. Pick up your special edition Celebrate Undies. They will donate $1 to the Los Angeles LGBT Center if you do so. And then Blinkist, Blinkist.com/capspace to start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan. Blinkist.com/capspace is that URL. We'll be back tomorrow night when we either know whether the Golden State Warriors are the NBA champions or their fan base is absolutely completely freaked out. We'll talk to you all then.